Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
Because this grand jury has been convened to indict leaders of social justice movements so the government can put them on trial and possibly in prison, none of us have cooperated, even though it means we seriously risk jail for refusing to testify.
We look first at the growing climate of fear in America, helped by political rhetoric and by the ongoing economic crisis here, as well as worry about the way the government is being run from Wisconsin to the nation's capital. We'll hear from journalist David Holthaus about his piece, Lone Wolves, A Recent History of Violent Right-Wing Extremism. We speak with him about the piece in the context of congressional hearings called by Representative King, chair of the House Homeland Security Committee. Then Maureen Murphy joins us. She's managing editor at the news outlet Electronic Intifada. Murphy is one of 23 activists in Chicago and Minneapolis to be targeted by the FBI for their Palestinian solidarity activism. The original subpoenas were issued to them in September, but when the activists, including Maureen Murphy, refused to provide any information to the FBI, they were called before a grand jury. Now there is a nationwide organizing campaign underway to get the FBI to call off activities that the activists are referring to as an FBI witch hunt. Human rights activists, peace activists, and environmentalists had hoped for change under Obama-Biden, but the same kind of targeted surveillance campaigns and invasive FBI tactics appear to be surfacing under the present administration that were a problem under the Bush-Cheney administration. Are progressives, leftists, and even moderates being targeted while some of the more dangerous right-wing activists go unnoticed? And many peace activists were quick to cry foul when the head of the House Homeland Security Committee, Representative Peter King, claimed Muslim Americans ought to work more with the FBI to inform on fellow Muslims who might be a threat. Activists that have been working against political profiling, racism, and anti-Muslim activities began to speak out. This is a short audio montage of King's original remarks that aired on NPR.
I believe it's important to have this investigation on radicalization of the Muslim community. We know that Al-Qaeda is trying to...
And I've met with Muslim leaders in my own community, and I asked them why they're not more forthcoming.
Yeah. And also I'm calling on Muslim leaders to be more critical in denouncing it.
Take your Sharia, go home! You terrorist lovers!
Terrorists?
Your hands are bloody! Your money is bloody! Get out!
You guys are no belong here!
Welcome here! Go home!
Now, as the hearing began March 10th, anti-Muslim protesters were able to get within a few feet of the Muslim families that were called to testify at King's hearings. Activists had contacted King's committee to ask that he at least make sure that the problem of right-wing extremism was addressed during the hearings, and this was King's response to the hearing.
This committee cannot live in denial, which is what some of us would do when they suggest that this hearing dilute its focus by investigating threats unrelated to Al-Qaeda. The Department of Homeland Security and this committee were formed in response the Al-Qaeda attacks of September 11th. There is no equivalency of threat between Al-Qaeda and neo-Nazis, environmental extremists, or other isolated madmen. Only Al-Qaeda and its Islamist affiliates in this country are part of an international threat to our nation. Indeed, by the Justice Department's own record, not one terror-related case in the last 2 years involved neo-Nazis, environmental extremists, militias, or anti-war groups.
We got that clip from the website Media Matters for America, where they've been covering the King hearings and also are featuring a story by David Holthaus, who has spent 5 years with the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, specializing in investigative reporting on right-wing extremism. David Holthaus has also been published in The Nation, Men's Journal, Rolling Stone, The American Prospect, and other publications. We asked him to talk about his reasons for compiling this troubling list of outright terrorist activity and also hate crimes committed by groups on the right.
Obviously, there's been a lot of anti-Muslim hysteria surrounding these hearings and the right-wing media's hyping of the hearings. And what I wanted to bring to light is that right-wing domestic terrorism and extremist violence in America is at least as much of an issue in this country right now as radical Muslim domestic terrorism, if not more of a problem.
Now, it's not clear who asked King or got King to mention anti-war activists in the same breath as he was mentioning some of the other more very scary people that might be involved with the KKK. But what about that? I mean, he said 2-year frame, there haven't been any kinds of threats, and yet you mention a very serious one involving a dirty bomb.
And there's a bit of rhetorical sleight of hand he's using there, which is to say, to equate, or to try and equate Al-Qaeda with, quote, neo-Nazis. Sure, there's no single neo-Nazi organization that I would say presents as much of a threat as Al-Qaeda taken as a whole. But if you start looking at individual actors, individual neo-Nazi domestic terrorists versus individual acts committed by radical Muslim domestic terrorists in America, clearly there is an equalization of the threat. In fact, the number of terrorist acts committed in America by right-wing extremists outnumber those committed by Muslim extremists since 9/11 or in the last 2 years, which is the time frame that Representative King cited, or whatever time frame you want to take since the 9/11 terrorist attack.
Now, your list that goes from 2008 to 2011 has a lot of horrific examples in it, but I think the most scary one has to do with the radioactive materials that were found in the home of a neo-Nazi. He was shot to death by his wife, and she told police he'd been mentally and physically abusing her, but that would have been a dirty bomb.
Yes, that was a longtime neo-Nazi in Maine who had been stockpiling radioactive materials along with instructions on how to make a dirty bomb that he had apparently downloaded off the internet. According to his wife, he'd been in contact with neo-Nazi groups. He was, according to her, extremely upset after Barack Obama was elected, which is sort of a motif with these lone wolf terrorists, and had been mixing chemicals in the sink before she shot him to death after, she said, years of physical and mental abuse.
Have things gotten more troubling over the last few years than they were before, or are we looking at a constant trend here?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The right-wing extremist activity in the U.S. has always had an inversely proportional relationship with the economy. Whenever the economy goes down, right-wing extremism goes up. That's been true since the early 1900s. Now, you add to that the election of the first non-white president, the rapidly changing demographics in the country, and you have a sort of witch's brew of factors that are fueling an ongoing spike in right-wing extremist organizing, activity, and violence. That's been clear for at least 5 years. The number of hate groups being tracked by the Southern Poverty Law Center has topped 1,000 for the first time since the SPLC started counting those groups in the mid-1980s. Another factor that's driving this increase is that after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, federal law enforcement agencies took a lot of the resources that they put towards tamping down right-wing domestic terrorism in America after the Oklahoma City bombing. They rediverted those resources to radical Muslim threats in the U.S. And like mushrooms in the dark, the right-wing hate groups, the violent lone wolf right-wing terrorists, began to flourish.
You can find the article by David Holthouse at MediaMatters.org. We turn next to Maureen Murphy, managing editor at Electronic Intifada. She was subjected to an FBI raid, along with 22 other activists working to support Palestinians.
So why did all of us refuse to testify? A grand jury is essentially a secret court. When someone is summoned to a grand jury, they are not allowed to have a lawyer or any witnesses present. There is no official transcript of the proceeding, and the jury is handpicked by government prosecutors. There is not even a judge presiding over the proceedings. The point of convening a grand jury is to get an indictment. And the famous adage goes that any competent government prosecutor can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Because this grand jury has been convened to indict leaders of social justice movements so the government can put them on trial and possibly in prison, none of us have cooperated, even though it means we seriously risk jail for refusing to testify. So the bottom line is that a grand jury is a tool that the U.S. government has used throughout the history of this country to unjustly and invasively investigate and disrupt political movements and detain activists without charge. So just to give some historical perspective about the kind of groups that have been targeted by the grand jury, it's been used to intern people organizing to abolish slavery in the pre-Civil War days. It was used to detain African-American community leaders during the Reconstruction period. It was used to detain labor activists organizing for an eight-hour workday. It was used to detain people, leftists and union organizers during the McCarthy era, and leaders from the civil rights movement, advocates for independence for Puerto Rico, and more recently it's been used against the animal liberation and environmentalist movements. That is why we have refused to testify, and we also have refused to testify because the subpoenas and the search warrants issued in September make it very clear that the U.S. government is interested in any associational information that we have. So they want to know the names and phone numbers of people we organize with here in the United States. And probably they also want to know the names and information of people we have met in places like the West Bank and Colombia, where many of us have traveled to learn about the human rights situation there. And for anybody who is familiar with the human rights situation in those places, for the U.S. government to pass along the information about activists to the repressive governments of Colombia and Israel, it is basically a prison sentence or worse for those people. So that is why we haven't testified. So who are we and why are we being targeted? Of the 23 of us who have been subpoenaed, 17 of us are women. 10 are members of trade unions. 7 are Palestinian Americans. We range in age from 23 years old to 71 years old. 11 are parents, and 7 have children who are 6 years old or younger. 1 is a great-grandmother. The targeted activists have worked with various organizations, including the Palestine Solidarity Group, which I help organize, Students for a Democratic Society, Columbia Action Network, the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, and Fight Back Newspaper, and some organized within the Palestinian American community. And so what do some of the targeted people have in common? The first 14 people who were subpoenaed in September helped to organize the protest of the Republican National Convention in 2008, which was one of the largest anti-war demonstrations in this country in recent years. We now know that this investigation began in the months before the protest when the Minneapolis-based Anti-War Committee, which helped organize the RNC protests, was infiltrated by a law enforcement agent who went by the name Karen Sullivan. Many anti-war and social justice groups were infiltrated around the time of the RNC protests, but this spy stuck around, becoming increasingly involved with the Anti-War Committee and later joining the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. So this professional liar used the Anti-War Committee to gain access to local peace and justice organizations and even took her surveillance work on the road, participating in the committee's name at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit last summer and several School of the Americas Watch protests at Fort Benning, Georgia. This person, who posed as a dedicated activist working towards justice, we now know was actually collecting information about organizations and individuals across the country. This law enforcement agent not only spied on, but also disrupted work of movements she pretended to be a part of. She elected to join a solidarity delegation to Palestine, but she and two other women from the Twin Cities were denied entry by the Israeli authorities at the airport in Tel Aviv. We now understand that, on her word, the government of Israel denied entry to these activists, preventing them from meeting with, learning from, and building ties of solidarity with Palestinians in the West Bank and Israel. The two activists who traveled with this agent, Sarah Martin and Katrina Plotz, are now subpoenaed as well. So the basis of this investigation, for which the 23 of us have been subpoenaed and which has upended our lives, is the word of this infiltrator. For 2.5 years, she lied to activists in the movement with whom she worked and pretended to befriend, and we have every reason to believe that she lied to get the search warrant on activists' homes and offices, and that she has lied to the grand jury that has been meeting in secret since August 2009, and that she will continue to lie in court if any of the targeted activists are put on trial. So what does the U.S. government say this investigation is all about? The government says that the raids and subpoenas are part of an investigation into violations of the law banning material support for foreign terrorist organizations. This legislation, the material support laws, was enacted with a bipartisan pact under Clinton, expanded with the Patriot Act under Bush, and expanded even further under Obama after the Supreme Court decided last June that political speech can be considered material support for foreign terrorist organizations if done in a coordinated way. And speaking about our case and these laws on Democracy Now! Recently, the leading progressive thinker Noam Chomsky said, this case is extremely significant. It's the worst attack on freedom of speech since the Smith Act 70 years ago.
There are events planned for the month of April, and you can learn more at unacpeace.org. We were able to interview Maureen Murphy when she visited West Hartford, Connecticut in March. Maureen Murphy, how long have you been working through the electronic intifada online as a news person?
I started volunteering for the electronic intifada in 2003 when I was still in art school, and I started contributing articles about film and culture. And then I moved to Palestine to volunteer with a human rights organization in 2004. And so I started doing some reporting for the Electronic Intifada then. And then when I returned to the United States, it was shortly before the 2006 Israeli war on Lebanon. And that's when I started getting more involved in the editing process. And I am pleased to say that EI has basically been my full-time gig since 2006.
And has the website gotten more hits since these developments with the FBI raids and subpoenas?
I'm not sure if that has brought us new traffic, but you know, there's so many stories happening on the ground in the Middle East, and there's so many stories related to the Middle East happening here in the United States with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And because so many more people are involved in the movement in support of Palestinian rights, we're seeing, I think, a general swell of not only our readership, but also people who are wanting to find out more information about the movement and what it's doing. We have been able to develop our publication into something that used to be kind of a supplement to the media, and now it's become media in its own right, and we're able to commission investigative stories, and we're able to break big news stories like how the New York Times' bureau chief in Jerusalem, son, is in the Israeli army, and how he's living in a home that was stolen from people who are now refugees. So we're able to break these really big stories and to have an impact, you know, on policy.
Why do you think it is, first of all, that the U.S. media has so profoundly ignored the story of what has happened to Palestinian lives because of, let's say, settlements, for example? I mean, that's a pretty straightforward story that was being done for decades. But it does seem as if in the last 5 or 10 years, we've seen a big drop-off in that kind of coverage.
I think the U.S. media is pretty terrible on reporting like any kind of struggle that or any kind of issue that involves people struggling for their rights. We have a for-profit media, so they are interested in selling a product, and what doesn't sell a product, it seems, is in-depth information that analyzes structures of power and holds power accountable. But what does sell is entertainment. So I don't think the media really fulfills the role it should, which is playing a role as a watchdog and holding power to account. And so we see that in, you know, struggles in Chicago when it comes to education and access to public services, and we see that with these broader international issues like what's happening in Palestine. So when you read an article in the New York Times, it, you know, you're not going to find the information that the United States basically subsidizes the Israeli military occupation. So when people try to follow this issue in the mainstream media, what they see is like tit-for-tat type violence, and this guy shook hands with that guy, but they're not going to be able to understand the power structures that allow the violence to happen and our government's role in it.
So you're talking about, let's say, the surface of what's going on in meetings about peace talks, for example, when you talk about the handshakes. And I know that was a big issue that we saw Arafat shaking hands in Washington, D.C., Rabin, you know, shaking his hand. One of the broad questions, you know, just has to do with the agenda-driven media. Do you see the lack of coverage as something that is partly driven by a decision that the story is really what Israel and, you know, well, let's say Washington on a given day say it is?
I think there is structures and filters on and self-censorship within the media. You know, I think they're motivated by two things when covering a story. I'm talking about the corporate media, and that's profit and access. So if they think that maybe their access to power is going to be cut off, if they portray it in a critical way, then they're not going to challenge what's happening. But the good news is that we don't have to rely on the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post and CNN. You know, we have seen basically the embarrassment of these mainstream media sources in covering the uprisings that's happening in the Middle East. So Al Jazeera has basically filled a spectacular void that has been left by these news agencies that have pulled their bureaus out of places like Cairo, out of other major international cities, and they have been left in the dust by Al Jazeera. And we also can now, because of technology, we are able to hear what's happening on the ground directly from the people themselves through social media. Not that I want to overstate the role in social media and mass movements and popular uprisings, but I think we have so many more resources to draw from when we're trying to understand the truth of a situation that I think people are able to come to an informed opinion on important issues much easier than they were able to before.
The general public did take a great deal of interest in the Iraq War and somehow got at the news and information necessary to realize, at least after a time, that the whole argument about weapons of mass destruction had been a lie. And then we're seeing now an interest in what's going on with WikiLeaks that I think has profoundly affected Americans, which is somewhat encouraging, but it reveals that, you know, social media, the internet, and smaller media outlets or websites like WikiLeaks have made a difference. So just talk about what your vision of making a difference is for electronic intifada.
One thing that I think is important to note in terms of the Iraq War, I recently read a report, and I don't remember the specifics, but it was something like 1% of all stories in the mainstream media last year dealt with the Iraq War, which is a pretty crazy statistic when you think Americans are being sent overseas and being killed to basically fight these wars for no real defense purpose. And that's not even to mention the countless lives of Iraqis and Afghans who have been killed as a result of the U.S. invasions and occupation. One of the things that we want to do at the Electronic Intifada is humanize these issues, to let the people affected by U.S. foreign policy be able to tell their story, and their story in full, that they're not just victims, they're not just people who are interesting because they live in a place of conflict, but also to share their culture and their own vision for how they want their to be able to live their lives. So that's something that we're proud that we're able to communicate and to facilitate.
And two, about what's been happening with you in terms of FBI subpoenas, does it seem to you in some way it resonates with things going on in other parts of the world that you're familiar with?
I feel like we have some things in common with Jewish Israelis who are standing in solidarity with Palestinians and who participate in, you know, demonstrations in the West Bank, because they too are being visited and summoned for questioning by the Shin Bet, which is Israel's equivalent of the FBI. So I think we can find some kind of correlation here between the work that Israel is trying to do to prevent Jewish Israelis from organizing and standing with Palestinians and what the United States is doing to basically criminalize solidarity with the Palestinian people in the United States. But I think both parties will be ultimately unsuccessful in this end. I don't see Jewish Israelis concerned about human rights stopping this from doing their work, and I don't think it's going to stop us from doing our work, and I think it's going to have the opposite effect in both cases.
Is this about media? Is it about activists? Is it something designed to put a chilling effect into the minds, hearts and minds of Americans? Just talk about what you see it as, and then talk about what you think electronic intifada can be as a sort of counterpoint.
Well, first, it's important to know that there's no reason to believe that I've been subpoenaed because of my work with the Electronic Intifada, and there's no reason to believe that the Electronic Intifada is under any kind of investigation. I've clearly been targeted because of my work with the Palestine Solidarity Group in Chicago, because I've helped organize solidarity delegations to the West Bank, and because of my work with other people in this movement to help educate and bring people to the West Bank so they can see firsthand what's happening on the ground because of the U.S.-funded military occupation. As we will continue to cover all issues affecting the solidarity movement, especially in the United States, we at the Electronic Intifada will continue to publish on this story, and we are glad that we've been able to educate people about what's happened with other political prisoners in the United States, particularly Palestinian-American community leaders who, before the 23 of us in the Midwest who have been targeted with these material support laws, they have been politically prosecuted because of their work to advocate for an end to U.S. military aid to Israel and for their humanitarian support for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. So we've been able to consistently report on those stories, and we will continue to report, for example, on the case of the UC Irvine 11, which are 11 students from University of California system who are facing a grand jury themselves because they participated in a nonviolent protest disrupting the Israeli ambassador to the United States when he came to do a speech at the University of California at Irvine. So they now face criminal charges because of this protest. And we ran a really excellent story that I recommend that people check out last week, written by Nora Barrows-Friedman. So we will continue to report on these important stories that show that the U.S. government is keen to criminalize a movement that is growing and claiming more and more victories.
Maureen Murphy, have you taken a greater interest in understanding the law and the Constitution? And have you learned anything about U.S. law in the context of what's been going on with this subpoena? What, if anything, has changed in the way you view being an American?
I don't think anything has particularly changed. I think it's reaffirmed my views that real change is going to come through building mass movements, through organizing, because right now these laws, like the material support laws that I'm being investigated for, are designed to politically motivated and motivated by U.S. foreign policy interests, not in the interest of protecting the public safety of the American people. So I'm going to, you know, and I think it's everybody who's been targeted as part of this investigation is going to redouble their efforts to organize and to mobilize, because that's going to be our best defense of our rights. It's not going to happen. We're going to fight it in the courts, but I think the real fight is going to be in the, you know, proverbial streets.
Maureen Murphy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Maureen Murphy is managing editor at the online news site Electronic Intifada. You can learn more about her case at www.stopfbi.net. We'd like to take a moment now to thank everyone who donated to the Public Affairs Department at FM 91.7 WHUS Stores, Connecticut, for Talk Nation Radio and a wide array of great programs. Thanks to David Hazeltine, the Public Affairs Director at the station. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program is taped in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. We'll put more of the audio from Maureen Murphy's talk in Connecticut on our website, talknationradio.org.